along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. A little bit later than usual this week. We're coming to you on a Thursday, but we are here and ready to pour over all the big news of the week and the big games of the week. Bernard Jackman is with me. How are you today, Birch?
Yeah, really good. Looking forward to chat.
And also on the line, a podcast debut to former Exeter Chiefs at half and fresh off the back of working with Ireland at the Women's Rugby World Cup, Gareth Steenson. Welcome to the show. Great to have you on.
Thanks very much, lads. Very excited to be here and have a chat with you as well.
We might just kind of dive straight in on the World Cup, because it's nice to get an insight from someone who was there a few weeks on from that quarterfinal defeat. How have you all been reflecting on it? Have you been able to park it? Do you still kind of in the middle of a night wake up and wonder what if?
A bit of that, yeah. You know, like, to be honest with you, it was a very disappointing way to finish, because we kind of figured it was going to be France we'd probably be facing. Maybe, you know, we talked about that game for a few months leading into it, realistically. And obviously how we went in the Six Nations against them as well. So we kind of had a plan. We figured we could do it. And we actually had, you know, we'd worked really hard. We'd actually had a fantastic training week leading into it. The girls really bought into the plan. The weather conditions obviously was a little bit hard. But the girls, again, they implemented the plan as well as they could. It's just probably we're one score short, maybe just before halftime. I think that's ultimately what cost us. But from a World Cup perspective and everything, the growth of the game for the women's game, you know, what they wanted to go out and achieve was phenomenal. And the support that we got from right across, not even just from the Irish support, but even people when we were there over in England, was great. And we were looked after incredibly well. Obviously, it's very disappointing that our whole goal was to make the end of the competition. And that was the one opportunity there to get that. And disappointing end, obviously, but again, it's a massive step forward for the game in Ireland, I believe.
We'll obviously be talking a little bit more in a few minutes around the Irish men's out-half situation and Jack Crowley and Sam Prendergast and how all of those things are coming together ahead of November. But obviously, you're working fairly closely with Dan O'Brien in that Irish women's team. And I'd be curious to get your thoughts on, as a player from her point of view, who's kind of, I suppose, been playing rugby since teens, coming from a Gaelic football background, what you're seeing in terms of the scope for improvement, what kind of talent is already there?
Yeah, look, this is the thing with GAA background, it's huge. I suppose with kickers, especially in the women's game, you know, we're looking to try and create as many of those as possible. Dana is an example. She's, you know, she's come into the game. She's got a great background with that kicking ability. And just from her rugby knowledge, I suppose, like anything, I spend a lot of time working with our halfbacks right across the board. And they're learning the game, and they're learning the game as they play it. And they're playing it. It's about giving them opportunities to play at the highest level possible. What I noticed was her development. So I was fortunate to work with her for a year, as other halfbacks in there. But once they started to understand the game a little bit more, they started to become more confident in what they were doing. They were starting to push the game plan forward. And ultimately, the plan that we went into the game against France, it was kind of slightly different to what we'd probably been looking to do as a development-wise, but we went with more of a kicking strategy. And they implemented it really well. And it was an understanding piece. And for their growth, what I've noticed, I've been in with them for 12 months. And where they were 12 months ago when they played New Zealand, a few months, you know, when they beat them over in WXV, to where they were in the World Cup, you know, they're starting to develop an all-round game, all-court game, understanding when to kick, when to run, all these different things. So the development piece is huge, and I do believe we're very fortunate in Ireland, especially with the girls that we've got, that they have that GAA background, so they have that kicking ability straight away. It's just building on the rest of their game as well.
Gareth, it's great to have you on. I've been a massive fan of yours, watching you play Premiership, Champions Cup, but also a lot of people I trust in the game say you're one of the brightest minds in terms of strategy, etc. Now you're moving into coaching. Obviously, you've been involved in the World Cup, but like, what's your coaching journey look like? Like, what's your next year look like in terms of who you're going to be working with? And are you going to stay across both games or focus on the women's game?
At the minute, you know, I'm very fortunate. When I came out of playing, I went straight into the Chiefs environment. I was straight in with Rob Baxter, Ali Heifer, that crowd. I went in and worked with the under-18s at Exeter Chiefs there, and was also a senior coach with a senior player. So I was a kicking coach in there. I got to work with the Chiefs women as well. So I had a bit of a grounding in that sort of zone. But for me, it was the opportunity to move back home. It was right. It was a time. It was right for me to move on and try different things. And to get in with the Irish women was great. I was fortunate to do a bit of work with Armagh Club Rugby last year. I've now been involved in an international stage where obviously been to the World Cup, Six Nations, bit of work in there, and been in around an Irish environment. But now I've got in with a bit of school rugby. So I'm actually in the space of, 4 or 5 years, I've been quite fortunate to see the whole dynamic a lot. Where it is right now, I'm doing a bit of work with Belfast Royal Academy as they prepare for their Schools Cup, which is coming up. And I'm out there, I'm trying to do a bit of coaching sessions myself. I'm available for going out and, just trying to develop the game and the knowledge of from a halfback development point of view. It's something I've noticed when I worked with the girls was, and it's something we spent a lot of time with when we were at Exeter Chiefs. We just spent a lot of time actually watching games. And what I've noticed now is people tend to watch highlights a lot more than they actually watch of the game. So trying to build knowledge right across the board, how a game moves, how it flows, how you talk to referees, how you talk to coaches, how you interact with people. I think it's a really important piece for number 10s and 9s and. But yeah, from a development point of view, yeah, I'm in with the school at the minute. And then here's hoping in the new year, whenever the Six Nations comes around again, potentially if there might be the option of getting back in with the girls again.
It's interesting. You mentioned twice their halfback development. A friend of mine who's recently retired, playing the top 14. He's trying to create a role for himself as a halfback coach. So effectively, like a kicking coach, like a contact skills coach. He's looking to convince top 14 or Pro D2 or URC directors of rugby that there's a role for a position like that as a consultant, where effectively on a Monday morning you sit down with the halfbacks and you review their game. You're part of the understanding what the game plan is for the following week, and you kind of bring them through also to do some kicking with them. But it's just such a key part of the game, the quality of your halfback's performance. And just hearing you doing a little bit more than just kicking, it's fascinating given what he's trying to create for himself, because I haven't heard that role really being in the game yet. And unfortunately, the way rugby finances have gone, there's probably less roles than more specialist roles than there was. But just last question, Gareth, and let Neil take over. As a halfback, ex-halfback, and someone who's watching the game a lot and coaching it, is there any trend you see that's making kicking more difficult, or more opportunity with kicking game, or anything with the law changes that have kind of impacted how you see that part of the game?
Oh, look, I think if you get your kicking strategy right, it can be as important a weapon. I talk about kicking as a weapon. I don't see it as a defense. Never have. It's about putting yourself in the right areas. It's about you want to put opposition under pressure. But like to me, if they put three people in the backfield, you should never kick the ball. You should run it. If they put two, there's a kicking space. If there's one, then there's double opportunities. It's about playing in the right areas of the pitch. The way the game allows it, the 50-22 rule coming in obviously is a really useful weapon. If you've got a strong line out and you can use your line out to effect, why would you not try to go after that? But that means then if the opposition decide that they're going to shore that up and not allow you to hit 50-22s, that means there's probably a space in the middle. So you ask any fullback, they don't really want to be under their own post with the ball in their hand. So there's loads of different things, wind conditions that you play into part. So from a kicking perspective, I think that it can be used as a real tool. It's something I've tried to work a lot on with the girls. To really think of it not just as we're just trying to relieve ourselves of pressure here. We're actually looking to use it and maybe how you can map out three, four kicks in a row in a kick battle that can actually get you into the right areas of the pitch, which then allows you to get your attacking game going. So there's loads of ways around the game that can be utilized. And I think just giving people a feeling, it's like anything. The game will evolve, players will evolve, people will have different strengths, weaknesses. It's about understanding that and implementing it with the team's perspective in mind.
We'll move on to the action, because I think we can actually kind of come back to this sort of stuff even around the kicking game when we're talking about the out halves and Jack Crowley and some of the stuff he was doing at the weekend. But the postponements of Ulster and Connacht games at the weekend meant it was a fairly light week for the provinces. Leinster, they've now lost the first two games of a season for the first time since 2003, beaten 39-31 by the Bulls in Pretoria. Bernard, do you remember who the two teams to beat Leinster in the first two games of the 2003-2004 season were?
No idea. No, go on. I wasn't playing.
One was
you
Munster.
You weren't playing, Bernard, were you?
No, thank God. I wasn't blamed for that defeat. No, I only joined 2005. One was Munster. Who's the other one?
They don't exist anymore. They only existed for one season.
The Warrior, Kelly Celtic, Warriors, no? Celtic Kelly Warriors, Warriors, yeah.
Munster 2-2 for the first time since 2021. They were 23-20 winners at home to Cardiff. We'll start with Munster. 2 wins from 2, although it wasn't pretty. I suppose it's kind of glass half full, glass half empty. Clayton McMillan obviously is pointing towards the we rolled up our sleeves and got the job done. Maybe you could look at last season. They might have folded on a similar night when things weren't going their way. The important thing is they are 2 wins out of 2 because they've had bad starts to the season over the last few years. Ultimately, got the job done. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, I'd be lucky. I was in Scarlett's pitch side and I was in Tomen pitch side. So I've seen Munster live. And obviously, it was nowhere near as impressive as the previous week was. But in reality, Cardiff offered a much bigger test than the Scarlett's did. The Scarlett's will be very disappointed with how they fronted up physically, the lack of questions they asked in terms of their attacking game, which made it very easy for Munster to be dominant in the collision area. So I think this is a new head coach. It's a new Munster team to a certain extent. And they've all, like, having 2 wins is a really positive start. And even how they kind of grounded out, I think they'll be disappointed with their breakdown accuracy. Now, that's down to Cardiff being incredibly abrasive and smart in that area. But that just took Munster out of sync. And then some of their handling let them down, which had been brilliant the week before. So was there a bit of complacency? Was there a couple of changes that just didn't have the same impact? I'm not sure. But more importantly, they'll obviously regret slightly not getting an attacking bonus point. But I thought Crowley just dropping into the pocket, taking that drop goal, making a 2-score game with whatever, 6-7 minutes left, showed really good game management. They didn't have Craig Casey. I think they missed him. They missed his leadership. They missed his tempo. And overall, and even some of the tries they conceded, they were kind of worldly tries. They, you know, there wasn't massive. Callum Sheedy was on fire. And like in every defensive system, there is space. And sometimes you've got to say, well, if they could put the ball in a sixpence there, well, fair play to them. And Callum Sheedy did. And even some of his handling for I think the third try was phenomenal. Tom Bowen looks like a superstar. But having said that, Munster got cut up, open up the middle a few times. They didn't lead to tries directly, but they certainly won't be happy about that. So, yeah, I think there's definitely things they can improve on. But I think Cardiff are a tricky side. We all thought, I certainly wasn't sure, we'd lose a match to Wales last minute, how's it going to affect them? But watching, having seen him play against the Lions and obviously seeing him play against Munster, this is a team with a bit of grit. And the way Matt Sherratt set them up to play, and he's been working that for 3 years, is still there. There's still a dangerous attacking side. So I think it's a good win for Munster, and with loads left in the tank to improve on.
And Gareth, Bernard mentioned the game management from Jack Crowley there. And like, it's very tempting. A few minutes to go, you're 5 points ahead. You've scored 3 tries. Very tempting to try go all out and try get that bonus point score. But just the kind of game smarts to step back and go, do you know what? 4 points, guaranteeing 4 points is way better than possibly going for 5. Step back into the pocket, knock your drop goal over, makes it an 8-point game, a 2-score match, heading down to the last few minutes. You can be pretty certain you've got the job done after that. And look, whatever way the chips fall, if you get your bonus point after that. There was that sort of game management stuff, but there was also the bit of gold dust early on in the first half, that little double kick that somehow didn't end up in a try for Dan Kelly. It was a really, really impressive all-round performance, and he is looking like a player now who's looking very, very confident to start this season.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's kind of, if you kind of look at what George Ford's doing, Sale, that kind of management style, he's getting a bit more time in the saddle, if you want to call it. You know, he's a little bit more confident what he's bringing to the team. He's becoming more of a leader. He understands what his value is in the team, and to stand there, it's very easy to all the things you kind of said there. It's about winning. Bonus points are bonus points. They're exactly what they say in the tin. They're bonuses. You've got to win the match. It's so important. You know, you're sitting there now. Munster are sitting there with 2 wins to start their season. They're far more better off with that under the belt than having potentially like 2 bonus point wins. You're better off having the wins. He's very much at the point right now where he's driving that team, and he's looking really, really good. You know, and I think that comes down to a bit like just the kind of like he's been in there a few years now, and he's probably come through, and he's probably been in situations where he's had to develop under a bit of pressure. He's had a bit of hardship, And he can understand when the time is right to pull the trigger, like those drop goals, taking 3 points. It's like you said, you take 3 points there, you go back, you give yourself an opportunity to go for the bonus point. You know the game's in the bag. Obviously, they didn't get there, but they've given themselves that chance and actually gives the team around them a confidence. And I'm sure forwards and Bernard will definitely adhere to this, that if you're comfortable that your 10's going to take the right decisions, you know that you can go out and you can carry the ball well and you can do your job well, knowing that he's going to back you up.
Stino, just the mindset of, and the kind of game understanding or game feel for 10, like, do you think that decision, there's a message coming on, you know, next opportunity, take three, whether that's a penalty or drop goal, or was it just something instinctively you would drop into the pocket there? Because it happened very quick. I don't know if you saw the Dragons game against the Sharks, where Dragons are on the Sharks line in the 83rd minute. They end up under the post twice, and Tinas De Beer was in the pocket, but never really seemed to call for it, and they ended up throwing a wild pass and end up getting a draw.
Crowley's done it before. I think a La Rochelle last year in the Champions Cup, when you know they're down to 14 players, it was just knock over those three, keep it ticking over.
Yeah, absolutely. And just in terms of, like, is it get in position quick, have a snap shot, or is it find a perfect position, and how do you manage that feel?
I think it's a feeling at the time. So the easiest way to do it is if I send to the guys, right, we're going for a specific drop goal here. A lot of people will be thinking, waiting for it. So if you know, your forwards are probably putting themselves in a position where, right, is he going to pull the trigger here? Is he going to do it? Why has he not done it yet? You know, whereas if you go flat out at something, the way we used to have plans around it, that only the halfbacks knew about drop goals, forwards were not privy to any of that kind of information. It was literally, you had an opportunity, there was a call that was made, and when you felt it was the right time, pull the trigger on it. So it's a little bit like, I suppose George Ford's a really good example of it now. He's doing them all over the place. And I know I've mentioned him already, but watching him, even what he was doing on Friday night when he was Sale were playing Bath, as an example, wet weather conditions, similar to what Munster were in. And he just kept the scoreboard ticking with hitting the drop goal here and there. He just keeps, like, it's very hard to defend. But if you know it's coming, you probably can put a bit of pressure on yourself. So it's easier as a 10's perspective, that it's like anything. If you see a kick space, you pretty much go to it with a feeling. And I'm sure Jack's probably much, he would have in the back of his mind, obviously, you know, the scoreboard pressure here. If I knock this over, if he missed it, worst case scenario was he was going to get the ball back from a restart, you know. So it was a good opportunity for him to put the game to bed and then go after a bonus point. So I do think it's more along those lines around a feeling at the time.
As a complete aside, watching that Bath game on Friday night, I love watching rugby in that sort of weather. It was absolutely miserable. Rain was chucking it down. The wind was so strong, the ball was getting knocked around like a balloon in the air. I love watching rugby in that weather.
Well, that's what we grew up with, that, didn't we? Exactly. Unfortunately, with modern stadium and quality of pitches, you need a really bad night of weather to actually kind of affect it, because normally pitches are quality all season long, and you see the same type of rugby. So when you get something in the middle of a storm like we did there, yeah, it does change the whole perfection of the game. And it's usually experienced guys like George Ford who navigate that best.
Yeah, it was great. I might stick on Crowley though, because it does lead us into November and thinking around how the at half picture is going to look in Andy Farrell's side. There's four games in November. There's plenty of time to spread minutes around. How would you like to see him approach that selection process, where you've got two games? Like we saw last year in the Six Nations, it was predominantly Sam Prendergast. I know Crowley got in at the end. In the summer, the two of them rotated one start each. Would you like to see each, like Prendergast and Crowley, get two starts each? Would you like to see him back one player for the duration?
Yeah, I think it depends on form. I think I'm fascinated.
What's the form saying?
Well, the form is saying Jack on form, but you have to take into account that it was very difficult against the Stormers for any player behind the forward pack. And then I think Sam has a good moments on Saturday, but the home game against Cardiff, Jack was definitely on form, looks really sharp, looks actually like he's put on a bit of bulk, but looks lean, and yeah, I think he started the season really well. By all accounts, he didn't take much of a break, he just wanted to get back into it. What I'm fascinated by is Munster-Leinster. I think I would be gutted if they don't play against each other. You know what I mean? And we should be beyond the days of final trials or probables or possibles around that. But it's just like, if everybody who has spoken passionately, either pro sex or pro Crowley or pro Prendergast, bought a ticket for that match, be sold out. You know what I mean? Because that is, and Leinster, you think, would imagine, would be strong. Munster should be strong. And make a judgment after that. Then you'll see who's in form, because you can make excuses for the South Africa tour. But I think that's a week before, or 2 weeks before they play the All Blacks. So I'd love to see them go head to head. I haven't seen them go head to head before in a real meaningful game. And I think that's the challenge. And after that, I think at some stage now, Andy's going to have to pick his number one. I don't think sharing it half and half November, or maybe half and half November, but by the Six Nations time has come around, we need to know who's our number one heading towards this World Cup, and make sure that the second choice gets opportunities and is very comfortable. So we end up in a situation, don't forget, you know, the World Cup quarterfinal against New Zealand, Johnny played 82 minutes or whatever, and in hindsight, maybe we didn't get enough minutes into Jack. So we knew, or he knew what he had to do. So, and we don't want to be in that situation again. And that was a situation that wasn't anyone's fault. It's just the way it played out. But I think that's half the reason, I would imagine, that Sam played so much last year, is they're trying to accelerate that opportunity. But I don't think it's nailed down by any manner of means. But what do you think, Stino?
Look, I agree with what you're saying there. Do you know, actually, in the basis of Sam, I think the tour that he's had has probably been the most beneficial thing that's going to be for him. You'll go back to what Johnny Wilkinson in 1997, I think it was, when he went on the tour to hell, what they called it, whenever they went and they got hammered. I think from Sam's point of view, he's come in relatively new to the system. He's playing in a team that is effectively a winning team and wins regularly. So he hasn't had a lot of hardships in the position that he's played. So when he's behind a pack that's maybe not on top, how does he deal with those situations? He's kind of learning on the hoof. He's learning in the saddle, which is really good from his development point of view. And he's probably, if you look at where Jack's at, when we talked about Jack understanding game management, when to pull the trigger and drop goals like that, he's been learning that for numerous years. And I think where you're at right now, I think with Sam, I think he's in a good team. He's playing effectively with Leinster, who is effectively the Irish team at the best of times. So he's in and around all those top quality players. He's playing with the Lions halfback, who's at the minute currently one of the best in the world. So he's in the right environment. He's just got to probably, from my perspective, when you watch him play, can he be what Johnny Sexton was? Can he be the guy who kind of leads it and not be slightly led, if that kind of makes sense? And it's kind of where Jack's at the minute, where when he's playing with Craig. So obviously Craig led the team, obviously, in the summer tour. And they have a great little relationship there as well. So I think it's just trying to, you talk about managing them in these situations. Jack's obviously got an opportunity at the minute on form. Jack's probably the guy in the saddle that I would expect would go well. But it's like anything. It'd be interesting to see how it plays out. I'm a big fan of both of them. I think the way they play, I think they're great because they complement each other really well. They're different to each other, so you can put whatever type of game you want to play, you can kind of pick to the style that you want. And Andy's very fortunate to have the two of them there.
You were talking there, Stino, about the point in a career where you go from being led to leading. When did you find that was in your career? Like, were you someone who, at a pretty young age, you were pretty comfortable taking on all that responsibility, or did you need a few years bedding into the system at Exeter, into the game?
You know, like when I first joined Exeter, it was like we were a championship club, so it was very much come in. I was learning the guys around me, and I was 26 at the time when I went into Exeter, so I had a lot of rugby under my belt. Now, I wasn't obviously at the high level. I was playing a lot of championship rugby. I'd been in round academy systems, trying to get in around development stuff when I was here. But when I got across there again, we were fortunate. We developed the team playing in the championship away from what you would call the big stage. So whenever we actually got ourselves into the premiership, we kind of were fortunate again to learn as we went. And there was no real pressure of winning trophies as such. We were a developing team, and I got to develop over the course of 3-4 years. And by the stage we got when we started becoming competitive, I was about 28, 29.
Right.
By that stage, that's when, you know, I had to be, I'd learnt the game from numerous different ways. We'd have had to evolve because we became more of an attacking team as opposed to a kicking team. So I was given loads of opportunities and I became a bit more older in the group. But I had loads of leaders around me. So if I give you Sam as an example, he's got loads of leaders around him. Caelan Doris, you start naming them, who's around him, James Gibson Park, they're all there. So he's going to have that probably learning passage now for the next couple of seasons. So like he can develop into a world-class 10, but there's no reason why Jack Crowley can't be the guy who keeps him at arm's length. And the competition between the two is going to be fascinating. You go back to Ronan O'Gara and David Humphreys when they were coming through, they're, you know, they pretty much would have been, these are the two guys I had grown up watching. And their rivalry, which then led into Rog and Johnny doing it as well. So you need two to compete. And I think it's really important that the two of them are kind of driving each other.
Any other thoughts on the Ireland international picture heading towards November? Any players kind of jumping out over the couple of weeks that might catch the eye? Or I think maybe given the Lions disruption, are we looking maybe a little bit more of a settled Irish team this November?
Yeah, I think it'll be reasonably settled. There's obviously three more rounds for people to put their hand up. And we'll obviously find out, you know, reasonably quickly who really impressed O'Connell, et cetera, on that summer tour. Yeah. You know, we kind of forgot about that because it was a little bit under the radar because of the focus on Australia and the Lions tour. But I think what something I think is interesting is that maybe we haven't thought about is the effect of that Connacht game and Ulster game being cancelled last weekend or postponed. So it'll be very difficult, if even possible, or that Richie and Stuart Lancaster will change their selection that they selected to play last week, for next week, right? Yeah. And that actually will have a knock-on effect on Finney Beelam, Bundy Aki coming back into the picture. Less so, for obviously, Ulster didn't have any lines or whatever. But for Finney Beelam, Bundy Aki, Mac Hansen, it may affect the amount of game time that they get before the All Blacks match. And I did something this morning with Andy Farrell, and that was something he said, and I hadn't thought about it, that effectively it affects two games selection rather than one. And it's totally understandable that whoever Stuart Lancaster picked last week or Richie Moore picked, they go again because they didn't get a chance to play. But when everybody else's, sorry, when the international players and the Lions players' reintroduction is being planned, they weren't expecting a postponement. So it's not the end of the world. But there is a chance, and he admitted this, that maybe some of the players who play against the All Blacks will have played one game and maybe some of them will have played no game. And I had a diesel engine, so I'm different than Steno or whatever, but it took me about 4 or 5 games to feel halfway comfortable. So the modern players is a lot more finely tuned. But just, it's not an ideal scenario. I certainly wouldn't say any player, if they had a choice, would want to go into an All Blacks test match on the back of one URC game or one club game.
Yeah, so I think like we're kind of expecting some players, from a Leinster point of view, some players are going to be drip-fed in this week, and then probably the rest will return for the game against Munster the following week. Couple of more bits I do want to mention around the Munster game. We'll move to Leinster afterwards. One thing in these first couple of games, and it's good to have Steno's insight as well on this, because Alex Codling has obviously came straight in after the Women's Rugby World Cup, and the lineup has been good in these first couple of games. But I suppose he did have a bank of work with them last season in that part-time role. They're playing Edinburgh on Friday night. Edinburgh, I think, is the game most Munster fans would probably still have nightmares over from last season. Down in Cork as well, when the lineup just fell apart. And it was one of those weeks when Alex Codling was away with Ireland, when he wasn't with Munster. And you could almost pinpoint those matches out when he wasn't with them last season, when the lineup fell apart. I suppose first to you, Birch, I might ask, just how much improved is it looking even in these first couple of games? And then Steena might give us an insight into the type of person Alex Codling is, because he's someone the public don't really know a huge amount about.
He's a lunatic, but I let Steno explain that.
In case anyone's worried, we did media with him during the Rugby World Cup as well, and he pretty much said those words about himself.
He's a great character, but I'll stick to the coaching part of it. I think it was far from ideal, but the circumstances, the way they played out, and given Ireland the best possible chance of competing. And I really admire Munster's flexibility and patience as well. But they're only patient because of what he brings, you know. So they've waited for him to come in. And I know he was doing work, you know, behind the scenes. But realistically, match day is really important. So, you know, the game against Edinburgh was an absolute disaster. But I have no doubt if he's there in the stand, you know, they can get a message on, they can adapt things so it doesn't become as brutal as it ended up. And I think that's it. That gives the hookers, that gives the lineup callers great security. So the guy who's working with you from Monday through to Friday on your plan, on your lineup plan, on execution, etc., is up there with a laptop, able to see things that you don't see. So if things start to creak, they can fix it. And for Munster now, on a continuous basis, they now have a full-time lineup coach. And, you know, if you want to be winning URCs or winning European Cups, it's non-negotiable, really, to have the right people on board full-time.
He's a bit of a character, Gareth.
Yep, you couldn't... Well, I'm glad he said those words and I'm not saying them. Listen, attention to detail, there's no better. What he did with the women's game, what he did with the line out there, I think there was a stat that we were running around at like 85-90% line out or something, you know. It was phenomenal. The difference he had made since he came in with the girls. I know the way that he got on, the girls loved him. All the attitude of what he did, the detail that he brought to them, the way he'd carry himself around the group, everything. He was a phenomenal guy. And the way he would interact, even with us as coaches, was great, because the learning that even I would have got from him, and I'm not in that field at all in terms of line out, but is what he would bring to a training session, how he would talk, how he would communicate, all those aspects. And Munster, you know, he was, from afar, trying to help as much as he possibly could. But to have him in on a daily basis, he was always in regular contact with all the guys down there. I know he was super excited to get in and get going. I think he literally, once we came back from the World Cup, he was back in, you know, straight back down to Cork within about 2 or 3 days. So, look, he's going to be a great asset. He's been brilliant everywhere he's been. I've been very fortunate to work with him last year. But, look, Munster are very lucky to have him. And a bit like what Bernard's just said there around, you need to have a set piece. If you want to be successful and do things, you need to make sure. From my perspective as a number 10, I want to know, I don't care how you win the line out, you win it. And it's important that it's a bit of what Munster were always about, the good, strong forward pack up front, dominant in the line out. It's back to their traditional values. So, and with the back line they've got, that's going to help with them firing as well.
Castle Troy Hotel would be happy. He pretty much was living in the Castle Troy Hotel last year. I don't think because his partner and his family are up in Ulster somewhere, aren't they?
Yeah, they don't live too far. They're on the border over here. So.
But he was he'd have a day off and he'd just be like poring over videos and of lineouts. He was pretty much resident at Castle Troy for I think seven or 8 months last year.
Yeah, I've heard some stories. He's essentially got this hard drive with about thousands and thousands of video clips of lineouts.
Yeah,
just there storing away.
Yeah,
and incredible.
You just got him a chocolate. Make sure he's got chocolate and a few sweets. He's usually all right, and then once he does another bit, he goes gets a piece of ice cream. You know, he's one of those that he's not happy. He's off down to McDonald's getting a McFlurry here and there. You know, so there's loads of things with Cotter.
He's a unique guy, great fella.
Yeah, I got to see him up close before one of the training sessions during the World Cup. We were given some vision access, and for a good 30 minutes before any other players were out on the pitch, it was himself and the three hookers out there, just doing line-out throws, not throwing at. At jumpers, just working on playing a variety of different games around their throwing. And it was absolutely fascinating to see him at work. One last little bit, and it kind of goes in line with the line-out stuff. I thought it was really interesting. Cardiff's first try on Saturday evening, it came from a tap-and-go penalty that they took about 10 metres out. I know it's kind of come in, I'd say since about 2020, we've seen the 5-metre tap-and-go just return like that. But we only really see it from 5 metres out. Teams rarely are going for it from any further out. I think in the first two rounds of the URC, I've seen maybe two or three different teams taking a tap-and-go penalty from around 10 metres out. And I am wondering, is this coinciding with referees starting to get way stricter around the double banking and the obstruction at lineouts? And is that a response? And the more I look at it, I think, do you know what? It does actually work to have a tap and go from around 10 metres out. you get a way better run-up. You get 5 extra metres of run-up compared to when you were 5 metres out. And, you know, you can get that speed. You can still get very, very close to the line. I will be really curious to see, do we see that creeping in a little bit more, the more referees and officials are clamping down on stuff at the line-out?
Yeah, I think, obviously, there's been a big clampdown on the double banking. Obviously, you can lose the ball in the air as well if the opposition.
But we're seeing a good few tries getting ruled out.
No, we are. No, absolutely. Look, it's a bit risk. You have to factor that risk in to kick into the corner. I would say, on the flip side, referees are very favourable to the attacking team in those close-in drives.
Yeah.
Like, you very rarely see anyone get done for sealing off. You very rarely see the opposition get a good jackal or counter-hook because there's so many bodies in around the ball. So what you see a lot of teams do is they just play for a penalty, and then penalty advantage, you pull the trigger and hopefully score a try if you haven't got the power game. I'd say also for Cardiff, there was probably maybe Azzurrahi wasn't there. The scrum wasn't a weakness for them, but certainly they wouldn't have had massive confidence. And they actually played they had a midfield scrum in the 22 and they made a balls of it. So, I maybe it's a trend that's coming in. To be honest with you, I actually don't really find it very entertaining. 15 phases, NO Exeter were brilliant at the put. 15, 16 phases of pick and goes isn't the most enjoyable part of the game for me.
Yeah,
it's a means to an end. You know, you got to convert it, and I understand how hard it is when you get in that close. So something that gives more opportunities for teams to get into that kind of combat mode, I wouldn't be a massive fan of, but I could see it becoming a bigger part of the game for sure.
Let's move on to Leinster. As I mentioned, 2 defeats in a row to start the season. First time in 22 years that's happened. 39-31 defeats to the Bulls. So, you know, a very, very strange game. Early on, it looked like Leinster were heading for another really long afternoon and were going to be in deep trouble. Then all of a sudden, it looked like they were heading towards a bonus point win. Then it looked like they might be losing with 2 bonus points. And then that Sam Prendergast interception, they finished the game with 1 losing bonus point. That's what they come home with. When I was previewing this game last week, I wrote that the performance for Leinster was so much more important than the result this week. I'm going to stick with that, and I think it absolutely was. They definitely got a much improved performance this weekend against the Bulls, and I think it eases a little bit of the worries after that opening weekend in Cape Town.
Yeah, no, you got to look at it from their perspective. They went over there the first week, difficult to take a result like they did. Then you're over there, you've got to still build yourself back up again, and going to Loftus is a difficult place. You've got altitude, all those things to take into account. And would you say it's a more improved in performance? Yes, you would. They've scored, they've got a bonus point try. To be in the situation they were, they would have talked probably about having a fast start, which obviously wasn't what happened, but the way they came back into the game and got the game going, and ultimately give themselves a chance of winning the game. It was one of those games where they'll have so many things they can learn from it. And for that group that went out there, again, like I said to you, the lessons that they'll have learned, they're going to be much better. They're going to be a much better unit for doing that and being over there. Like, there's no doubt they're better this week, getting prepared for their next game. So from a coaching perspective, they're obviously going to be frustrated. They would like to have obviously taken probably 1 win away from home in that scenario. That would be, you know, I'd say a par enough performance if you go to South Africa and you come away with 1 win. So they'll be disappointed from that point of view. And again, a disappointing end, obviously, for what happened with Sam, but they all looked like they were out on their feet ultimately whenever at that point. And I understand being down there, the altitude and everything that goes with it. So look, if you look back on it, you know, there was 10 tries scored in the game. It was a great game for an advertisement for the URC as well, if you wanted to look at it from that perspective. But from Leinster, like, again, they'll be disappointed, but they know they've got a lot of firepower coming back now over the next couple of weeks.
The intercept with Sam Prendergast at the end, it's actually, the way he started the season, it is reminding me a little bit of how Jack Crowley started last season. I think of that game against the Stormers in Cape Town when Munster were on that early season trip to South Africa, and they're trying to get back in the game late on, and he kicks a restart straight out on the full, and things were just starting to pile up on him. As Gareth kind of mentioned earlier on, he's going to have learned an enormous amount out of these couple of games. It was felt like a real mixed bag from him. Some really, really good. I thought at times the way he was linking up an attack was excellent. There were a couple of kicks maybe that went a little bit too long, and that was allowing the Bulls to run it right back at them. And I think that's how they scored their first try early on. How do you kind of assess that performance overall?
Yeah, I thought it was some really good stuff and some average stuff. And the average stuff for me wasn't necessarily the intercept at the end. I think the problem for Sam is he's a very languid style and he can be quite lateral. But he has such good passing and pass a sense of what the defence is doing. If other people aren't lateral and are direct and there's good lines, he can put people through holes. But yeah, in that 5 seconds of the game, everybody just looked unbelievably gassed, lateral, flat. And in hindsight, he should have tucked it or just given a soft pass.
But it is one, when you look at the replay, you're looking at it going, I don't even think it was on.
No, it wasn't on. But it wasn't on. But the reason 10s are so special and the good ones are so valuable is they try and impact the game in a meaningful way. So, you know, the kickoff that goes dead, you know, It's the easy thing to do is just bang it down the middle of the field. Like you want them to have the capacity and the character to go and make big plays. You know, to drop in the pocket, all these things. Like that's why they're so rare. The brilliant tens and Sam, in fairness to him, will try and impact the game, and he'll make mistakes on the way as everyone will. But I think I think there was enough in the game to see. At least Leinster's attack looked like it had a plan of how to exploit a very average Bulls defence, whatever. And he did, whatever. And he was part of that. So that was good. Just the long kicking stuff. The challenge is, and it's easy in hindsight, is the challenge is when you play the Bulls, you don't want to get caught in your own half, whatever, right? But in hindsight, given it's a bit of a scratch Leinster team, if your kick chase isn't right, you will get exploited against the Bulls because of the firepower they have in the backfield. So in hindsight, and Leinster started to do it, when the ball is kicked long to you, you're better actually if you counterattack, create a ruck, get your players in position and then kick a contestable. Mm-hmm. Now the risk is obviously you don't only get caught too far behind your forwards when you run it back. But Leinster started to do that a little bit more, kick the ball contestable, and that limits the threat that the opposition can bring you, particularly a South African team at altitude, you know, because they're just looking for a mismatch, they're looking for a forward slightly out of place, and they exploited that. So I think there was a learning from that, but I don't think it's all down to Sam. It's actually maybe tactically they should have had a clearer plan around how to limit that X factor that the Bulls have in the backfield.
We would have been talking about this last week, and we would have picked the three obvious areas where Leinster were just completely second best against the Stormers. Scrum, line-out, aerial contests. Aerial contests at the weekend, Andrew Osborne had a really good impact early on in the game, won a couple of balls back. Tommy O'Brien then in the second half started to win some balls as well. They were way better in that area. Line-out, I think they might have lost one or two line-outs over the course of the game. It was absolutely solid. And unlike last week, the stats don't lie. They were actually able to use the ball. Scrum, they weren't even at just level par at the weekend. They were the better scrum on the day. Thomas Clarkson was excellent on all across the pitch as well. So I suppose, obviously they're coming away. It's a second defeat in a row. But the three really, really poor areas of their game, the three obviously poor areas from that first week, looked a hell of a lot better at the
beginning. To be honest, I don't really care that they're, I don't think it's worrying that they're two losses.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the first game was so bad.
Yeah.
You had to analyse it as it was. But realistically, the reason Leinster haven't had two losses is they haven't had to travel to South Africa first up and first second. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, this has been a more disjointed season than normal because of the Lions players, because of how many players Leinster provide for the Lions, or for the international tour. And they've given the likes of Paddy McCarthy, Andrew Sparrow, Hugh Cooney, you know, some game time. Like, it's gold, you know? It's gold. It's not ideal, but as Steno says, like, they will find out a lot about each other down there. Like, it's like in a development pathway, they say if you're developing young athletes, you know, they want to spend some time where they're nearly the bully, they're freewheeling, right? Because they're so much better than the players they're playing with or against. Sometime when you're up against people who are the same level, and then sometimes when you're actually struggling. So exposure to all three is kind of what they say makes the type of mindset that you need at the highest level. So Leinster don't really often get that. There's Leinster players, they come into a team with Caelan Doris and Dan Sheen and they're far superior to the opposition and then they're just freewheeling, you know. So I think it's great to see them in an environment like that. But also it's very important that they did answer some of the questions around physicality, around the line, around the scrum, because you don't want to be coming back, although they have an easy game this weekend, you don't want to be coming back home on the back with no positives to take from it. And they certainly have some.
Yeah, and they'll be welcoming some Lions back in this week. Stino, on the Bulls, they're in Belfast this weekend taking on Ulster. Bulls are 2 wins out of 2, but they're not looking spectacular. They're looking like a very open side. They look kind of easy enough to score against. I know Ulster kind of will be frustrated not to have had a bit of a run out last weekend, but based on what you saw in the opening round against the Dragons, would you be expecting Ulster to pick up 4 points, maybe 5?
Yeah, well, again, it's difficult for the Bulls travelling over. It's always going to be difficult for that with their trip. Again, Ulster are going to be champing in the bit. The good thing was from the Dragons game, you could see that attacking flair. You could see Mark Sexton's obviously implemented that attacking flip philosophy. There's a lot of good noises coming out of Belfast from the fact that the guys are really enjoying it. And you got to see it a little bit against the Dragons. From a tack point of view, all those sort of things you touched on, yes, the Bulls, yes, they've obviously got 2 wins in their belt, but against different whenever they have to get in the plane, they have to travel, they have to get themselves across. It's always difficult, especially the potential that the weather could be a lot different. You know, very likely the weather will be a lot different. So, look, I think Ulster will be excited about the opportunity that, like you said earlier, they've had a week off. I know they were buzzing about getting across to play over in Edinburgh last week and the frustrations around it, the plan that they had put in place. So, once again, it'll be good to see that they'll have seen opportunities, no doubt, around that Bulls defence, how they can get after them, how they can, a bit like what Bernard's saying again, can they look about maybe implementing that sort of kick compete on the Bulls, taking away their strengths, maybe keep the ball on the field, keeping it away from the forwards, run them about. So, like, Ulster in a good spot now. I think the way they're looking to play the game, it'll be a good test for them, obviously, to come up against a team that's got a couple of wins under their belt, bit of confidence as well. And it's a good barrier to see if they can kick on from where they were last year as well.
I think Stino's right. I think there was so much to like about how Ulster looked attacking wise, and you look at the Bulls' defence, what they concede, 40 points against the Ospreys, more than 30 odd against Leinster. There's a lot of holes in that, and I think sometimes the Bulls, they defend with brute force on their mind rather than actually making good decisions. And yeah, if you put the shapes that Ulster look like they want to put against them, people will make the bad decisions. But also, I think there's two things that I think about the Bulls. Is one is Ackerman, obviously, his philosophy when he coached the Lions to a Super Rugby final, what he tried to implement in Gloucester was very much attacking rugby, and that's very different than Jake White, who's the previous coach, who was way more pragmatic. But also, over the last couple of years, I've seen him being way looser at home than they do when they come to Europe, and it's like they use altitude to their favour and say, well, we can go toe-to-toe with this team in a chaotic game, and because it'll favour us, mm-hmm. it'll favour us. And even under Jake, they were involved in a lot of high scoring games, but they won most of them. So are they going to come over here and keep trying to just outplay teams and be frantic, which does suit some of their individuals, but I think they'll get hurt badly by Ulster if they're very chaotic and very crazy in how they play. But or will they actually say, well, this is how we play at home, and then when we come to Europe, it's a much more modified stranglehold type game, which would make it harder for Ulster maybe without the athletes to unlock them. So that's going to be, after one game in the North, if they've got more subtlety to it, or are they just going to try and play Baba style rugby with a lot of pace and power?
Yeah, so that's one of the Saturday night games. I might finish up, guys, just to mention OR360, because we spoke about this last week, Bernard. You called it the fire festival of rugby, but last couple of days, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Ireland, England, Scotland, France and Italy, all of their rugby unions issued a joint statement essentially saying each of the national unions will therefore be advising men's and women's players that participation in OR360 would make them ineligible for international selection. They say they welcome investment and innovation in rugby, but they say they must take a wider view on new propositions and assess their impact on a range of areas. OR360, they say, has given us no indication as to how it plans to manage player welfare, how players would fulfil their aspirations of representing their countries, and how the competition would coexist with the international and domestic calendars. They haven't closed the door on speaking with OR360 and getting the answers, but for the moment they are saying, if you play in this, you're not going to be eligible for selection. the fact that they've made all of this statement together, Wales and Argentina being the only two of the major nations not making that statement, it does indicate they are actually taking this as a serious threat.
Yeah, well, they have to, because so many players have signed pre-contracts, you know. Yeah. So if your asset is actually signed a contract to potentially go somewhere else at the end of the current contract, you need to be worried about it. I think they know the ace in the hand that they have is international rugby. So you, like, the player will want both. The player will want R360, massive contract for less games.
Yeah,
bit of a traveling circus for a while, meet new people, live or spend time in different cities. Like, it's all very attractive, and then go back and play Six Nations, play World Cups, etc. Yeah. The challenge for the unions is the most important, the draw they have is international rugby. But underneath that, international rugby and the fact that if you hold to that a Caelan Doris can't play for Ireland anymore, it's unlikely he'll accept that, right? And that means Caelan Doris is available for Leinster as well. And likewise, you know, the RFU don't own the English clubs, but they're their stakeholders. They have to try and protect them. So it's shot fired. The challenge is, until R360 get the money to pay the players what they're promising them, there's no decision to be made. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all based on if they get sell this franchise, if they get his TV deal, etc. And now the challenge for Mike Tindall and his group is to go and put together the financial packages that could reward players with unbelievably lucrative contracts compared to what they're on now, and then put the unions to the test to, if they're going to hold firm on that. Because the actual reality is R360 want to work with the unions so the players can play international rugby. So they're not trying to take away the players from international rugby. But the fear I would have is that if those top end players aren't playing for the Waikato Chiefs or the Bulls or Leinster or Saracens, what effect does that have on the domestic games in those countries? And that's the unions have to think about that too. That's the challenge.
I'd be interested to get your take, Gareth, as someone who spent all of their career in England and obviously as a result never got the chance to earn an international cap.
Yeah, no, I suppose it's all circumstantial, isn't it? When it boils down to it, the way, if I look at somebody who's maybe at the end of their international career, who's maybe in around it, like, it would be quite, that'd be quite nice to say we're going to go play 7 games or 8 games, whatever it may be, and, you know, you get well paid and you get to travel the world, all the things that Bernard talked about there. Does it give you an opportunity? From my perspective, if it was me, I'd be interested in the fact that I get to play regularly against world-class players, if that's the type of players that are going to be coming in. But again, in the Premiership, whenever I was there, I was getting to do that anyway, because it was at the stage that, you know, there was world-class players in that, in around it. So look, it's interesting at the point. I understand completely why the unions, you know, were doing it. It makes complete sense from their point of view, that, bit like you're saying, keeping a hold of their assets. And ultimately, if you're looking to develop yourself as a player and you're young and you want to play for your country, well, you know, you still will have those. If you're from Dublin, you're going to want to play for Leinster. If you're from Belfast, you're wanting to play for Ulster. So at the minute, we don't know a lot about the teams that are actually going to be, where they're based, what they're about. And I suppose until it's actually out there exactly what it is, it's, as from a player's point of view, it would be something you'd want to listen to, just what it is. But again, you're understanding where you're at in your development of your rugby career. If you're wanting to play and aspirations playing World Cups, and if that was the hindrance, you know, a lot of people would want to take the opportunity to play in World Cups if they can. I know I personally would have loved the opportunity. It is interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the coming months.
Just interestingly, it's mainly NRL superstars who are being linked to it more so than the Antoine Dupont's. You know, the big names in Union, the Finn Russell, etc. Not a word.
Yeah.
It's some high profile rugby league players in the NRL, and then they're talking about some ex internationals and some maybe young players to boost up. So it may end up being, if it goes, it may end up being a little bit like the basketball used to be in Ireland, where every team had the two Americans the rest, you know, they were the stardust. So each team might have two or three big names, but could be like Manonu's, you know, Manonu's still doing very well in Toulon. But that type of profile, is that going to sell out the new camp? I don't think it will. So they either need to get all the top talent, and then the players would love it because you're being exposed to British and Irish Lions type tours with, like, not just Four Nations, you're getting the best, you know, three or four All Blacks, three or four Springboks, you know, the best Ireland French players, and that could be really exciting for players. And then seeing your payslip every month would be pretty cool too. But I'm still skeptical.
Yeah, we'll have to revisit another day because we are running out of time. A reminder: games this week in the United Rugby Championship, Friday evening, Munster against Edinburgh, 7:45 PM kickoff. Then the other three provinces in action Saturday: Leinster against the Sharks Saturday, 5:30 PM Aviva Stadium. Cardiff hosting Connacht. That could be an absolute cracker, 7:45 PM. And then, as we mentioned, Ulster against the Bulls, also quarter day kickoff up in Belfast. Bernard, great as always to have you on. Gareth, thanks a million for joining us. We'll have you back on again soon enough, I hope.
Thank you very much. I'd love to come back on, guys. Really appreciate you having me.
And we'll speak to you all again soon.
Cheers.